all, it's a great pleasure to be here, and I thank the organizers for inviting us. I also, as I commented to Professor Salim and Passot, it's just great to hear their lectures earlier today, because it's a very nice lead-in to some of the developments in the gyrokinetic theory area, which, as I'll say here, is motivated in large part by some of the very, very exciting applications challenges in the area of plasma physics. And as David also said, unfortunately, I'm only going to be able to be here today because I have constraints in terms of lectures back in Princeton. But I didn't want to miss the opportunity to come. And so I'm giving this first lecture, and then my colleague, Dr. Chin, will give the next two lectures. And this should be a reasonable lead-in into the following two lectures, because this really sets the motivation for why you want to develop the next step in the gyrokinetic formalism to deal with the challenging problems that are emerging that now look tractable. Okay, so let me go over, first of all, the lecture topics. I'm going to start off with an introduction where I'll talk about the motivation. And the motivation, and I'll show you a picture basically, is to gain the scientific understanding, improved scientific understanding of magnetized plasmas in both laboratory and under natural environments, such as in a space or astrophysics environment. Then I'll go over the basic ordering that is appropriate for particle motion and strong electromagnetic fields. This involves really, at the most basic level, as you heard in the earlier lectures, it involves separating, if you will, the fast gyro motion of a particle spiraling along a magnetic field line, decoupling that from the slow guiding center motion. The guiding center motion, as you heard earlier, involves the particle motion parallel to the field, but drifting off of it slowly with respect to drifts such as the polarization drift and diamagnetic drifts and so forth. And then the next phase, the next topic is the development of the formal gyrokinetic Boltzmann-Maxwell system of equations and getting it into a reduced form that's tractable for solution, both in terms of simple analytic limits, which I'm not going to go into here, but also setting it up, if you will, in a form that is amenable to numerical simulations. And here, this is quite interesting because it allows us to really couple two dynamic fields. One is the area of computational science, where we take advantage of the tremendous advances these days and continuing advances because of Moore's Law with respect to the powerful computational platforms that can be utilized to help us solve some of these equations in highly nonlinear regimes. Not that we can totally trust those results, and people should have no illusions about this, that the codes are only as good as the foundations upon which they sit, and no one has the arrogance to believe that we can exactly simulate Mother Nature, so it's a continual process of checking this to constantly improving the simulation capabilities. So then I'll show you some results from these advanced simulations and close with some comments about future challenges and directions and the need for more general gyrokinetic formalism and a possible approach. And this will lead quite naturally into the next two lectures by my colleague, Dr. Chin. So this is just the motivational slide. Basically, the application arena is plasmas, and as most of you are probably already aware, it makes up over 99% of the visible universe. And what's shown here are the parametric regimes and temperature and number density in which plasma physics is applicable. And this is the area where a lot of the work is here. In laboratory plasmas to develop a magnetic fusion capability to address energy issues, but also at the more basic science level in solar physics and astrophysics and so forth, this all comes into play in these parametric regimes of interest for which you need the ability to solve the plasma systems of equations. And in this field, I think we can take heart because unlike other areas like in biology and perhaps even in high-energy elementary particle physics, just the formulation of the basic equations is a challenge. Here we know, because this is an area of classical physics, where we know we have to solve the Boltzmann-Maxwell system of equations, but doing so, as you heard in some of the earlier lectures, is very challenging, and let me get into that a little bit. So the plasma physics challenge to theory and simulations is really quite formidable. As you can see, there's a huge range of spatial and temporal scales. This is a slide that I usually show for in a motivational introductory sense. Here are spatial scales and temporal scales, and here are very familiar sorts of length and time sequences. This is the Debye length and so forth. And the point that I'm trying to make is that to encompass all of the physics relevant to the plasma physics applications, you span more than 8 orders of magnitude in spatial scales and 15 orders of magnitude in temporal scales. You're not going to do this all at one time, very obviously. This tells you that when you address the physics, you have to introduce intelligent ordering schemes. But the point that I'll make here, too, and making a connection with my introductory comments about advanced computing, is that the overlap in the scales often means that a strong simplified ordering, and even not so simplified ordering, where you can capture several scales, is still not realistically applicable to some of the science problems that you're trying to address. And here you then need the computational capabilities to assist you. So what is the basic ordering? Again, this is in line with a lot of what you've heard over the course of today. The general ordering for strongly magnetized plasmas at the most basic level is simply that the gyro radius, or Larmor radius of the plasma, is small compared to the equilibrium scale length of the magnetic field that you're considering. Remember, we're talking about strongly magnetized plasmas. Now, here rho is just the definition of the gyro radius, with V being the thermal velocity, omega being the cyclotron or gyro frequency. And now this is at the most generic sort of level, but let's deal with a topic that was again discussed in the earlier lectures. Consider the case for low frequency, and let's look at electrostatic waves as a start. But this ordering also applies to some of the electromagnetic shear alphane type waves. What you're talking about here is our frequencies. Here omega means frequency, and here omega is small compared to the cyclotron frequency. This is a typical ordering that's appropriate for the physics regimes that you want to look at, both in many laboratory and space plasma applications. With respect to the perpendicular wavelengths, these are of order or less than the perpendicular wavelength is still longish, but can be of order the gyro radius, so it's less than or of order unity. But the parallel wavelength is very long, typically, for the phenomena that you want to consider. So K parallel is very small compared to K perp. And again, and rho over L looks like this rho over L, but here, in addition to the magnetic density gradient scale length, this is basically a measure of the inhomogeneity of the magnetic field that you're looking at in the equilibrium. When you're looking at the equilibrium state. But rho over L is taken to be small in a lot of the plasma physics applications, where L can be the pressure gradient scale length too. When you have any kind of a confined plasma, or even in a natural plasma where you have pressure gradients or spatial gradients in the density and temperature or velocity or whatever, this L could mean that. This could be a density gradient, a pressure gradient, temperature gradient scale length. The associated formalism that you would then bring into motion to solve this problem removes the fast gyro motion from the kinetic system for low frequency, long parallel wavelength phenomena. And what it then does, if you apply all of this, is that it leads to a more tractable, that is, simplified version of the Boltzmann-Maxwell system of equations. And what does that look like? Well, this is what it basically looks like at the simplest level. This is the whole thing. This is the total time derivative of the distribution function on the left-hand side. The right-hand side is an appropriate collision operator. And here is the ordering that results from what I just talked about on the previous slide. And usually what we're talking about here are, in addition to dealing with equilibrium or slowly evolving quantities that we take to be in a sort of quasi-steady state sort of scenario, and don't worry too much about the time evolution of the change in such quantities, that in addition to the equilibrium scale, we're dealing with a perturbed scale. And if you're talking about some of the macroscopic or MHD-like behavior that was mentioned earlier, what that corresponds to is the kinetic analog. If you solve for that distribution function, the response that you get is like the response to a displacement that you introduce to a macroscopic or MHD problem. So these are the two pieces. This F hat here is the total distribution function, and it has the equilibrium piece, and it has the perturbation piece. And E here, the script E, is the electric field and the force part of the Boltzmann equation. And it involves both an equilibrium electric field component and a perturbed quantity, which is phi here. So phi naught is just the equilibrium potential. And again, C is the collision operator on the right-hand side that captures the binary collision dynamics. So if you then look at the ordering here, let me come back to this in a minute. In the equilibrium, where you're not worried about the temporal differences, this is by far the fastest term here. This is the gyro frequency term. And so this is small, this is small, this is small, this is the dominant piece. And so what are the consequences of that? And in the perturbations, this is small, but these terms can be of order unity. And I'll come back to this in a minute. Let's focus on the equilibrium for now, because our focus here is we're going to solve the equilibrium equation and justify that when you solve this equilibrium equation with this gyrokinetic ordering, the solution will be a Maxwellian, a local Maxwellian. And so the gyrokinetic equation, if you put in the specific pieces and you put in the appropriate velocity space terminology, this is V perp dot grad F naught. This means the leading order equilibrium distribution. Mu here is just the usual expression for the magnetic moment, V perp squared over 2B. This is the parallel velocity. N hat here denotes the unit vector in the direction of the magnetic field. But this is V parallel N dot grad V perp. And this is the equilibrium potential. Sometimes we throw that away for simplicity. But this is a key term here. This is the big term, the cyclotron frequency term. And this is the collision term on the right-hand side. So this is the gyrokinetic equation governing the equilibrium, and if you average over phi, the gyrophase angle, this, then this reduces very simply down to V parallel N dot grad F naught is equal to the collision operator operating on this leading order distribution. And the solution to this, you can show this very easily, a local Maxwellian will satisfy this relationship. And so this is usually the starting point for a lot of the kinetic stability studies in a magnetized plasma. Now, the perturbations are more challenging to solve, and the gyrokinetic equation governing the perturbations can be written down like this. This, again, looks familiar from what we had before, where for now we're going to ignore the collisions as being small, so this is more like a Vlasov version of this. And the notation here is I've separated out the adiabatic part of the response. This just means that if you introduce a perturbation, that the plasma, especially the electrons, tend to thermalize any perturbation along the lines. And this is the Boltzmann-like response to that. And we pluck that piece out and then solve for the rest of it, which is contained in H. And so now, in solving for this equation, it's convenient to introduce, again, the concepts that were discussed in detail earlier, a guiding center prescription or a guiding center coordinate system. And here, the psi and the chi represent, if you're dealing with a torus, this is like the radial direction of the torus, and this is like the poloidal direction or the short way around the torus. And I didn't put it on here, but in a typical problem that you would apply to, you would have a donut-shaped confining magnetic field. And in this direction, the toroidal direction, that's a direction of symmetry, axisymmetry. And that is this coordinate zeta that I note here, zeta. And this is just, again, the gyrophase angle. And what I'm saying here is this. And this is important to keep in mind. Why am I even doing this? You're doing this because to solve this equation for the distribution function, it's convenient to solve this in the guiding center coordinate system. But you have to keep in mind that you're going to have to solve this together in a self-consistent way with the rest of Maxwell's equations. Now, the rest of the Maxwell's equations are what? They are in the laboratory frame. So once you get the distribution function in this guiding center frame, you've got to transform back to the laboratory frame when you solve the field equations. And so that complicates the issue, but it's a doable problem. And so the prescription for the donut-shaped magnetic confinement system, which happens to be the one, the shape that the magnetic fusion people are pursuing most aggressively these days in identifying the best magnetic trap to keep a hot plasma confined for a sufficiently long period of time to generate net nuclear power. In any case, so in a toroidal system, you can break this down into these components for the magnetic field. I'm not going to dwell on this very long. Zeta is really the toroidal angle, the long way around. The psi is the poloidal flux function. And the basic thing to note, if you do this transformation, is that it converts the gyrokinetic equation for H into a very simple form. The leading order is just dH d phi prime equal to zero, and then you go to the next order to calculate what the first order distribution function is going to be. Now, this is all well and good, and people have done this for the last 20 years or more, but I'll give you a warning right now that for a wider range of problems where you have to deal with the full electromagnetic perturbations, this is fine for electrostatics and also for situations where the electromagnetic waves are relatively weak. And so for magnetostatics and electrostatics, this is a perfectly fine prescription. But if you have growing electromagnetic waves, what does that mean? What that means is that the magnetic fields themselves are growing. Okay? And in a linear sense, these prescriptions are probably okay. But in a nonlinear sense, it's not okay. If the waves grow to sufficient amplitudes, they can change the equilibrium, which changes the way that you set up this whole problem. In other words, what are the right orbits that you're following if the perturbations are now interfering with the ordering of the equilibrium? And so the prescription that you need under those circumstances is what we call a gyrocenter coordinate system, and that you need a much more complicated formalism to deal with that, and I'll say some more words about that a little later. But for now, you know, just to take you into the problem, working at this level, which is one that kept people very, very busy for a lot of years, this is fine for now. And so the gyro average of the next order equation, if you turn the perturbative crank, you know, dH d phi was equal to zero. So at the next order, you gyro average, and you get this expression. And if you get this expression after, let me not trivialize it, it's a lot of algebra with a lot of you have to be a very good bookkeeper about getting it down into this particular form, where these brackets here on any sort of term here like A just means the gyrophase average of the quantity. And what this is going to do is when you take this gyrophase quantity and you transform this back to the lab frame, which is what's happening here for the electrostatic problem. This is the Poisson equation in terms of the potential. And as noted earlier in the earlier lectures, if you are looking at sufficiently long wavelength modes, this is just a small correction to the right-hand side. These are just the perturbed density responses. And you can throw away this term, and formally, it's fairly easy to show this if you stick in a distribution function in a simple analytic limit, for example, like for electrostatic drift waves, and you can see that these terms are of order unity compared to this correction term, which is of order k squared lambda Debye squared, and if you're dealing with wavelengths that are clearly much longer than a Debye length, this term is negligible, but if you're dealing with very short wavelength modes, then you have to keep the full Poisson equation. So this is the so-called quasi-neutrality condition. And as it was noted in earlier lectures, it just means that the density responses of the ions and the electrons balance each other. And so this is basically what you do. You solve this for the distribution function, you plug it in here, and you self-consistently analyze the problem by coupling it to Poisson's equation, which controls the electrostatic potential. Now, this can all be generalized to the electromagnetic problem, and that's what's done here. So this is, in fact, the gyrokinetic Boltzmann-Maxwell system of equations. And here I've deviated some from the toroidal-specific problem and just wrote the magnetic field here in generalized Clebsch coordinates and highlight again the fact that what we're trying to do is we're trying to solve for this kinetic distribution function in a five-dimensional phase space. And this little function h, the non-adiabatic part of the distribution function, is what you're solving for, and this is the gyrokinetic equation, but now generalized here to include what? Well, I put in F naught instead of putting in the Maxwellian. In simple limits, you get back to what I had earlier, and I also have, as you notice here, the electromagnetic components, the perturbed perpendicular and parallel magnetic fields. And so this is the full response in the gyrokinetic Boltzmann-Maxwell system of equations. It's still the Maxwell equations that one typically considers for low frequency waves is still simplified. They're reduced. You're throwing away things like the displacement current, which just introduces a very weak correction to the problems of interest. But nevertheless, this would be the full system here. These are the other two components of Ampere's law that you need to solve for. And solving this whole system of equations is what you do when you analyze perturbations kinetically in a magnetized plasma. Now, to do this, there are various things, and there's many, many papers written, and I apologize, I didn't list here a lot of references and things, but as I was chatting with David at lunchtime, when it comes time to write up these lectures, I will put all of the references in there so that one can see where these things come from, and indeed some of the applications, because you can take these equations and solve them in certain limits. You know, if you make approximations about the large subsidiary orderings, if you will, to arrive at analytic forms of the distribution function, for which you can calculate the perturbed density responses and do the electrostatic problem, and even do some electromagnetic problems this way. But to do the most rigorous sorts of analyses, you have to turn to advanced computations to help give you the insights that you need for the highly nonlinear problems. And this is a sort of a busy slide, but it captures a lot of interesting things, not just for plasma physics, but for many areas of science. One of the programs that I've been involved in, both with at a national level, both with regard to Department of Energy science programs and National Science Foundation applied science programs, is to try to promote cross-cutting collaborations or discussions in various areas that are interested in utilizing advanced computations to drive the science forward. And the philosophy there is very simple. As the advanced computational platforms evolve so rapidly, following Moore's law, you know, every 3 years you have to replace some of the commodity processors in local clusters and such, rather than having a lot of people, very smart people, sitting in their separate silos trying to reinvent the wheel, so to speak, it's good to try to get people to crosstalk, because the platforms are evolving quickly. And aside from just the utilitarian part of the pragmatic part of getting people to crosstalk, again, similar to the comments that David made to me at lunchtime, it's very good to get cross-disciplinary sorts of scientific dialogue going. And this is an area that draws people in, because people want to see progress in their scientific agendas accelerated. They want to know how to use the advanced computational capabilities efficiently. And so I think, a very interesting growing area. And there are new institutes, interdisciplinary institutes in computation, popping up at various major universities, at the University of Maryland, at Princeton, a number of other places. So the thought here, and people believe this across the board, is that in terms of application science, advanced scientific codes are really a measure of the state of understanding of the natural and engineered system that you're considering. It is a measure. I mean, it's not an absolute measure, but to the extent that you can model phenomena, that gives you a measure of how well you understand things. And how do you do that? Well, first of all, you target, okay, what is the problem that I'm interested in doing? And the first thing that you do is you do what is at the heart of this particular series of lectures, which is to come up with the theoretical foundations that you can build a model on. And so the theory or the mathematical model is the essential piece at the very beginning. And so you formulate the mathematical model, but then as you enter into like what I just showed you, and the previous thing was all mathematical in terms of what we were talking about. Now, if you want to get beyond doing asymptotics and calculating physics responses in restricted regimes, and you want to especially deal with a very tough nonlinear evolution problems, what do I mean by that? I mean, if you can do linear theories analytically reasonably well without a lot of high-powered computations. You can use the computations to get very realistic onset conditions or threshold conditions for the onset of an instability. But then you get into a lot of trouble when you say, well, if I've excited many, many waves in the system and they're interacting dynamically, what the heck am I going to do? It's not weak turbulence theory if there's a lot of them there. And so you need the simulations to guide your insights into what's going on. And sometimes it's very interesting that the simulations will give you ideas to go back to, like there was some discussion earlier about well, you know, what is the nature of the entropy production and what for the type of problems that you're looking at and such. You can go diagnostically into a well-validated simulation, and you can measure the entropy. And you can diagnostically analyze that to try to give you insights into how you can then put together mathematical models of higher physics fidelity. So what do you do then? You take the mathematical model, you go to your computational physics colleagues, and at the same time you also talk to the computer scientists who can help you with regard to the system software and the latest platform development, and you also have to talk to the best applied mathematicians who can steer you to the best mathematical algorithms that make sense for putting the code together. You then put together a model, put together a computational tool, and you make computational predictions with that. And what you do is, first of all, and I want to reemphasize this, is that you do analytic cross-checks against the reduced models that we talked about earlier. If it cannot at least reproduce things in regimes, and some people are impatient and say, oh, come on, those are irrelevant regimes and such, but if you can't hit the mark with your codes in regimes that may be research-wise not that exciting, people that come from a long history of analytic type studies are not going to believe this very much. And so you need to do the analytic foundations type benchmarks, and to do that as best you can, both linearly and nonlinearly, like as we mentioned in the discussion phase of the last talk, you can set it up such that your simulation kicks off, let's say, three unstable waves, and you can do a weak turbulence theory on that, and that predicts a certain saturation amplitude, and the question is your simulation reproduce that? The other acid test, if you will, is you get, you know, really sophisticated, high-powered codes running, and you ask yourself, does this really agree with observations and experiments, laboratory experiments? And what do I mean by agree? And agreeing means comparisons, and these run the gamut of several things, and it's really kind of amusing that you can take a simulation result and it's a pretty picture of some kind, and then you put that up to an observation and say, see, these look very similar, so my code's got to be right. Well, I think that's hardly adequate. What you need to also do is then you have to do what we call looking at what global trends there are, in other words, spanning a wider range of parameters. Are you still able to predict trends that look pretty similar? And then at a more sophisticated level, you can actually calculate, simulate, if you will, detailed structure like spectra, correlation functions, and so forth, and see to what extent the measured spectra correlation functions are tracking things. Sensitivity studies, what I mean here are, you go to an experiment that you're hoping to simulate properly, and you can say to your experimental colleagues, well, the simulations indicate a great sensitivity to the density profile. And if you change that by a factor of two or three, you're going to see a big change in what you measure. And the question is, do you see that or not? And if the answer is no, you shouldn't be insulted, because the point is that to be able to put together theoretical or computational models like this, you're never going to completely reproduce Mother Nature. So it's a continuous cycle of discovery, if you will, but it's an exciting cycle of discovery. And I personally find this very stimulating, because I think it opens the door up to a lot of bright young people who come into the field, and some get the impression that well, come on, you know, it looks like a field that's been worked over some. The cream has already been skimmed off the top, and there isn't room for contributions and such. Well, with the advent of much more powerful simulations that are properly validated against theory, and where new results are able to be generated, I think that's changing, and this is attracting, I think, a larger number of young people into the field. So what do you do here? I mean, so the last point that I would make here is that the rest of this flow chart says that if the answer is yes, that the trends look very good, then you keep on applying it until you hit some nodes. One is this side says that the code is too slow, and you go back into this box here, computer science and algorithms part, to try to improve the code. If it takes a month of Sundays to do a systematic run, then it's not terribly useful, and so you want to speed it up. You're not questioning the science or the physics fidelity of the code, but if it's really not agreeing very well with observations, it doesn't mean the observations are absolutely correct either. But sometimes you have to go take a step back and say, well, wait a minute, you know, the regimes that I'm really trying to address, I'm leaving out some key physics components in the equations that I'm solving. I can't be making those approximations. And then you come back to the mathematicians and you say, well, look, how can I include this term to make the problem still tractable? So it's a continuous collaborative process to be able to produce these advanced scientific codes, which in the 21st century are more and more viewed as tools for scientific discovery. So let me give you a specific example of some application in this area, and that has to do with the topic of turbulent plasma transport. Now, this is different from some of the topics that were mentioned earlier with respect to more fluid-like MHD type or magnetohydrodynamic phenomena. This is really dominantly kinetic phenomena, long mean free path dynamics, where the dissipation is coming from wave particle resonant type behavior. So how are you tracking all of this? And why is this important? Well, at a practical level, it's very important for the magnetic fusion research area, which is an area where there's a tremendous amount of investment internationally in trying to come to grips with designing the most efficient confinement systems. And if you go to a situation where, and there's been tremendous progress made in this area, which I'm not going to get into here, but for a plasma to ignite, in other words, get to a state where the reaction produces more energy than it took that you pumped into it to start the reaction, for that to happen, you create situations where the fusion self-heating, the alpha particle generation and such that comes out of a fusion reaction, that is stronger than the leakiness, the turbulent losses. So the notion is that, you know, if you confine a plasma, let's say in a magnetic trap of some sort, like a toroidal trap, that you have a lot of free energy, thermodynamic free energy in the plasma. Mother Nature doesn't like it for that the plasma is trapped like this. It tries to use every conceivable path to try to escape. And the trick is to try to keep it. The challenge is to try to keep it long enough to keep bad things from happening. If you can suppress the macroscopic behavior that was talked about earlier, where if you excite MHD instabilities, the game's over because it's just too lossy. But if you're able to, and the progress that's made in this field tend to indicate that you can control a lot of the macroscopic disturbances, not for tremendous periods of time, but for reasonable periods, the question is the plasma still sufficient? Will that then ensure success? And the answer is no, it won't ensure success. Because kinetically, that's a fluid description, remember, and the kinetic dynamics of the plasma, these hot charged particles that are moving around in this ionized gas, will engage in wave particle-like behavior, wave particle interactions, and various other dynamical processes, which do what? They excite fluctuations, electromagnetic fluctuations, which causes the electric and magnetic fields to grow. That really inhibits the efficiency of the confinement system, and it becomes leaky. And in fact, if you excite a lot of electromagnetic waves, or even a lot of electrostatic waves, what that does is it creates a turbulent medium that accelerates or increases the loss process, the cross-field diffusion process. It's not a rapid disruption or termination of a plasma, a hot confined plasma, but it's just leaky. And so if you're successful, basically you have to balance this fusion self-heating against the turbulent transport losses. So understanding turbulent transport is very important. It's also very interesting that if you do understand this, or as you make progress in doing so, discussions between the laboratory plasma physics people and the astrophysics people also have further intensified interest in this area of research, because the associated dynamics of this cross-field transport, there's transport of energy and particles, but there's also transport of momentum. And the transport of momentum is of interest to understanding accretion disk dynamics that impact the explanation for black hole behavior in astrophysics. So this is a very rich area and is recognized as a very important problem for a number of fields. It's clearly a scientific grand challenge problem in that sense, because it's very hard to do. You're dealing with turbulence involving many, many waves that are excited. In many instances, it's a highly kinetic regime. And even for computations, you know, people for a while thought, oh, great, we can put this all in the computer and the computer is going to solve it for us. That's not the case, because as I'll show you a bit more, as you get the results that come out of the simulations, it's almost like a numerical experiment. You have to diagnose it and deal with the data glut that comes out of a big computation. But it is a true terascale computational problem. And what do I mean by terascale? I mean, terascale means 10 to the 12th. 10 to the 12th floating point operations per second. This is, you know, the compute power has really, really moved up pretty dramatically. So in the plasma microturbulence arena, there has been very exciting progress made, and this has involved national, multi-institutional, grand challenge type initiatives. I won't go into all of those, but what it basically has produced are realistic geometry codes that incorporate realistic geometry in the toroidal magnetic bottle or traps that we talked about. There are codes that calculate the dynamics in the full torus. That is, the no approximations, basically dealing with a full torus. This is very challenging, but there's good progress made on that. There's also more efficient flux tube codes, where you just deal with an annular region of the plasma. In other words, you take one slice of it radially, and you calculate the dynamics in those regions. Associated with these global or full torus 3D codes and these flux tube or more local codes are different algorithmic approaches and formulations. And with respect to these gyrokinetic simulations, there are particle and cell simulations, and then there's also continuum or Vlasov simulations. And in a nutshell, the PIC simulations basically involve, and I'm going to explain that a little bit more, involves following the individual particle dynamics in an F equals MA sense. And the Vlasov continuum method basically involves solving this five-dimensional phase space problem on a grid. There are advantages and disadvantages to both, but the point that I'll make, though, with respect to the gyrokinetic particle and cell codes that were pioneered many, many years ago by John Dawson and others, is that they scale very well on the massively parallel processing machines that are out there. That these codes, but what do I mean by scaling well? It means that if you give it more compute power by going to many, many processors, it looks like the code can use it efficiently and track up. And so these gyrokinetic PIC codes, particle and cell codes, have already demonstrated scaling beyond thousands of processors, and this is quite exciting. So the problem description is as follows. The key issue I've already talked about, confinement of high-temperature plasmas by magnetic fields in this donut-shaped configuration. The pressure gradients that are naturally there in the plasma will drive instabilities, producing a loss of confinement due to turbulent transport. Plasma turbulence is a nonlinear, chaotic, five-dimensional problem. Chaotic in the sense that we don't completely understand the exact nature of turbulence. And as was commented in some of the discussions following the earlier lectures, if there is a true chaotic evolution, then all bets are off because a lot of things really change, like the field structures can change too, and it just becomes very, very difficult. And that's a possible outcome. But the point that I'm trying to make, though, is that plasma turbulence encompasses all of this, and it's a five-dimensional problem. Now, the particle and cell simulation approach, in contrast to the continuum or Vlasov, five-dimensional grid approach, is to calculate the distribution function by integrating along the characteristics with the particles advanced in parallel. The interactions with the self-consistent electromagnetic fields is the tough part in all of this, that you have to do this self-consistently. And so here's our familiar equation again, the Boltzmann equation. And basically, if you classify it, it's a nonlinear partial differential equation in Lagrangian coordinates, shown here. In the particle pushing schemes introduced by John Dawson and Ned Birdsall and others and many, many years ago, you're basically following the individual particle orbits. This is their velocity and this is their acceleration. And the representation of the individual particles is captured here in this Klimontovich-Dupree representation as point particles, an ensemble of point particles that specifying their position and their velocity. And once you've solved for the distribution, you have to simultaneously come back and satisfy the constraints contained in the Poisson equation, which advances the field in this electrostatic problem. Now, for the electromagnetic problem, you have to also solve Ampere's law and Faraday's law. And the point that I'll reemphasize again is that these are linear partial differential equations, these field equations, in Eulerian coordinates in the lab frame. You're solving this in the Lagrangian coordinates in the frame that is convenient to solve for the particles, this particle distribution. And so another point with respect to these simulations for plasmas is that the, and I mentioned here again, Buhneman and Dawson in their work over 40 years ago, they recognized early in the going that plasmas have a very interesting characteristic. You can really treat them as finite-sized particles because of the presence of the Debye shielding effect. And so finite-sized particles and particles in cell simulations taking advantage of finite-sized particles has led to a different generation of PIC codes shortly after their inception. The Coulomb potential is modified for a finite-sized particle, very obviously due to Debye shielding, and you no longer have to satisfy this sort of criterion for individual particles. When you're dealing with a number of calculations for n particles, if you did direct binary interactions, it would go like n squared, but for a particle and cell, it's just n. And the collisions are treated as subgrid phenomena via Monte Carlo methods, and these are well established techniques for doing so. Now, even with that, the ability to simulate realistic systems was hampered by the fact that it still took a long time to do all of that. Now, in work by Willie Lee at Princeton in the early 80s and his colleagues, this is where the gyrokinetic formalism that came out of the mathematics that we've been discussing was there 20 years ago. Actually, 10, 20 years ago prior to this, it was being developed all along. But it took some interaction between analytic theorists and computational expert like Dr. Lee to formulate the gyrokinetic particle simulation method. And basically, it takes the gyrophase average Vlasov-Maxwell equations for low and applying them to low-frequency instabilities. And what it basically follows now is the spiral motion of charged particles being modified as a rotating charged ring, as shown here, subject to guiding center electric and magnetic drift motion, as well as parallel acceleration. So this is really a manifestation of, this is really the dynamics of what you're trying to do, because this is really the true guiding center, if you will, motion of gyrocenter motion of the particles as they move along the field line and they drift off, capturing drifts like the polarization drift and such. And the practical consequence of this, being able to capture this in the simulations, was huge because it sped up the computations. Instead of following each individual particle along their orbits like this, but instead being able to do this, it sped up the computations by 3 to 6 orders of magnitude in time steps and 2 to 3 orders of magnitude in spatial resolution. So suddenly, you were able to do these computations much more realistically. And it led to the a new set of results that, when coupled with a modern powerful computational platforms, massively parallel computers, it enabled us to come back to this turbulence problem and come up with some very interesting results. A very interesting result that is of practical interest is the reduction of turbulence that is observed when certain conditions are satisfied practically. And I'm going to talk about this in a second. What do I mean by this? This is, of course, of great interest because, as I said earlier, you need to keep turbulence controlled to advance the agenda for magnetic confinement of fusion plasmas. In these simulations, what was basically done is as follows. You first benchmark these against linear thresholds and such. You basically follow the gyrokinetic particle scheme that we just talked about. You solve this. This was solved as an electrostatic simulation. The electrons were treated as an adiabatic population, just following a Boltzmann response, but the ion dynamics were treated in complete detail. And it was very, very interesting because what happens is that when you created conditions where the ion temperature gradient was sufficiently anisotropic and actually fit situations and experiments, you could drive a spectrum of instabilities. And in their nonlinear evolution, what was speculated and actually proven to be quite plausible is that if you have the beating of two waves with frequencies very close to each other, you could generate a very low frequency, just through mode coupling, you could create a K parallel equals zero mode through mode coupling. And that's basically, that mode, a zero-zero mode, is basically a modification of an equilibrium electric field. So what's happening is that as a result of the nonlinear beating of two unstable waves in the spectrum, you can create, if you will, an equilibrium electric field that is radially non-local, which means as you come across the radius of this plasma, it provides a shearing action because E cross B is a force, and if E is varying as you go across the field, the E cross B shearing will, if that's sufficiently strong, it can disrupt the coherent structures that are going to just build up if you didn't do anything to the nonlinear evolution of the instabilities. Because, and that's shown here in this figure here, that if the instabilities are excited, you create these ballooning-like structures, which are basically ballooning in the sense that they're only here on the weak field side of the plasma. This is a strong toroidal field side over here. So without this shearing action, you can do a numerical experiment to prove this physics hypothesis by suppressing the zero-zero mode. You can just damp it out. Don't allow it to happen. And what happens is that nonlinearly, these eddies, these long finger-like red eddies are there. These are just like walkways, if you will, for the particles and energy to walk across. And it makes sense from a physics standpoint in that it's saying that Mother Nature is trying to create a situation to make the plasma more leaky and create a situation for the plasma to escape more readily across these channels. Now, what happens is the self-stabilization, which can be introduced if this self-generated shear flow, E cross B shear flow, can happen. And in the simulations that were reported in this paper by Dr. Lin, and for which he did this is he began to look at this in some of his thesis work at Princeton, and then during his postdoctoral period, he brought a lot of this to fruition by using really the full power of the modern computers to do this calculation. And what was demonstrated is that if the self-generated shear flow, which can do what? The shearing action is in this direction here, and it can rip up these eddies. If you rip up these eddies, what happens? Then you don't have a nice walkway anymore for the particles and energy to walk across. And so you should see better confinement of the plasma. And the thing that's very interesting is that experimentally, when they try to create, this is a situation where the experimentalists paid some attention, because instead of the usual situation where they come and they say, well, here's the phenomena, and then we try to explain it after the fact, we basically were telling them, if you created situations where sheared flow could be present, you can expect to see better confinement. And they found that. And so that's why this appeared in Science magazine, because it was a very interesting scientific discovery that was validated experimentally. And this is what you actually see more explicitly here. Here's the linear phase of the simulation. And the turbulence decorrelation by self-generated E cross B flow, this E comes from, as I said before, the beating of the unstable waves to create an equilibrium electric field that shears these coherent structures. So without flow, that's down here. This is the linear phase where these mode structures set up these channels. And non-linearly, as time evolves, it's still there. I mean, you can still see these structures. But if you allow the flows to develop by changing the conditions in the plasma that allow you to do this, what happens? You can see the flow breaking up. And right here, you have a pretty turbulent situation with no coherent structures, thereby making the plasma less leaky. And so this is quite interesting. And I think at this stage, would like to show you a movie of this dynamical process, because just to emphasize the fact that this is indeed you can look at this as a numerical experiment at times. And unfortunately, the system here was such that I couldn't embed this movie properly, so I have to now It says to be, has to move it up the, yep, here we go. Great, thanks. Okay, now here, I hope you can see this. This is the full torus here, and here is the linear phase. This is without flow, this is with flow. They look exactly the same, don't they? But then as this evolves in time, pretty much the shearing action comes in and boom, the structure breaks. And what's happening here is that you suppress the presence of that equilibrium sheared electric field that gave you the E cross B forces that broke up this coherent structure. Here it's totally turbulent, and in the other case there's no coherent structures here, where this ended up with coherent structures that are still there. So the point then is that when these results were generated, the experimentalists were also very, very interested, because indeed this looked like a touch base with some actual phenomena that were observable, and in fact they could, if not directly measure these effects, they could certainly see the net effect of the shearing action improving confinement in the plasma. And so people got excited about this, and as the capabilities improved, this is where we're dealing with laboratory plasmas of this size, but if you go to the next generation big ignition plasmas of this size, you're going to need more powerful computational capabilities to get up there. And it looks like that's all on the horizon too, because just in we can do some of the simulations of this right now, and this gyrokinetic toroidal code requires 1 billion particles and 125 million grid points using more than 1,000 processors on the present machines to generate these pretty realistic simulations. And this is what gives us hope for the future, that if you plot the performance, this is the compute power, which is really just the number of particles in millions which move one step in 1 second, plotted against the number of processors. This is the old Cray T3E machine, and this is the IBM SP at Berkeley. And you see the trend is looking very promising. And in more recent applications to the big supercomputer in Japan, it looks like this is still the Earth simulator. It looks like this trend is continually tracked. This is the downside of things, that as you generate these big simulations, it's like an experiment. You will generate a tremendous amount of data. And so you need to also develop techniques with visualization, so you can visualize with movies and with better diagnostics what you're getting out of these codes. These results, this type of analysis, the coupling between analytic theory and its manifestation in simulations and such to give you more insights, as I said, it's not a final answer. It's a continuing cycle of discovery. And it's of much interest to other areas of physics beyond laboratory plasma physics, space physics and astrophysics in examining reconnection dynamics, dynamos and such, other collective phenomena, high energy physics, the collective dynamics impacting advanced accelerator performance, industrial applications, plasma processing, materials design and so forth, and certainly with the computational physics community, who you're constantly talking to about better ways to solve PDEs, adaptive mesh refinement in dealing with more complex geometries and so forth. So where are we in all of this? Well, this all motivates developing even more powerful gyrokinetic formalism or theories to deal with the challenges that are still out there. And what we need is a more general gyrokinetic formalism to address fully electromagnetic perturbations which can distort the initial equilibrium. So the problems where the magnetostatic models are no longer appropriate. Remember, in all of these simulations and all of the calculations we've been talking about, we talked about solving for an equilibrium and taking that equilibrium and leaving that static, not changing that equilibrium. But if the perturbations, especially electromagnetic in nature, electromagnetic means fluctuating magnetic fields. There can be situations where they're sufficiently large to change things. Now, what are you going to do when that changes? Because even the basic formulation of following the orbits and things are going to change if your equilibrium model changes. But the good news is that there has been some progress made with a more comprehensive approach that involves the application of Hamiltonian dynamics and differential geometry methods to develop what we call a gyrocenter coordinate representation. And the associated, what we call a pullback transformation that Dr. Chin is going to talk about, is used to solve for the distribution function. This pullback transformation is employed to solve for the distribution function that we've been talking about, perturbed distributions. And it enables the efficient treatment of several physics effects, the polarization drift density response in the gyrokinetic Poisson equation, even in the electrostatic limit. You can capture this much more transparently and easily with this approach. The polarization current response, this is just the velocity moment of this, in the gyrokinetic Ampere's law, and even here, modifying the equilibrium. The pressure balance for the gyrokinetic equilibrium is enabled when you go to this more formal treatment of the problem, which we have high hopes for. So my last slide is this, in terms of future challenges and directions. I'll summarize by saying that a more general gyrokinetic formalism is certainly needed. You've witnessed a lot of, I think, very exciting progress that's come from a combination of analytic advances in analytic capability coupled to computational models that are properly benchmarked. But more general gyrokinetic formalism is needed to address critical physics challenges that involve fully electromagnetic perturbations which can distort the initial equilibrium. The advanced gyrokinetic computations that we've been talking about have been based on solid analytical theory foundations and benchmarked against experimental observations where possible. This is accelerating scientific progress in many fields. And a summary of what has happened in the plasma science area in terms of progress in applying advanced computational methods to problems that are well posed in terms of the mathematics is discussed in this review article that came out in Physics of Plasmas in May of 2002. Final comment, a comprehensive analytic approach which involves the application of Hamiltonian dynamics with Lie algebra and differential geometry analysis is the subject of the next two lectures by Dr. Chin. So I'll conclude with that. Next. Well, not exactly. I mean, qualitative sense, they do things that are not exactly this, because this is like a self-generated shear flow, you know, because of the nonlinear evolution of these instabilities, right? But the thesis that comes out of this is that the equilibrium electric field that's radially varying across the plasma gives rise to this E cross B shear flow. Now, experimentally, they can't do the self-consistent generation of that, but they can create sheared flow by doing other things, like the way that they heat the plasma with beams, you know, they can create a net flow, right? That sheared, yes, right, neutral beams that are injected, or with radio frequency heating and such, you know, they can create situations where you generate an effective equilibrium electric field. That's not exactly what's done here, but and that's one of the problems that I've been pushing my colleague Dr. Lin to do is to go back to the gyrokinetic simulation that he wrote up in Science, reintroduce an equilibrium sheared electric field that doesn't depend on the self-generated flow, and see what happens, because that's a more direct connection of the type that you're talking about. Then if it's very sensitive, if that knob is very sensitive, then that gets very exciting in the interactions with the experimental people.
Well, on the first comment on this slide,
yes,
you're saying that you need to have a formalism that actually can capture the perturbation of the initial equilibrium. But then it seems like the ordering is broken at the very beginning, because in the gyrokinetic formalism, you still need to have a basic equilibrium and a small perturbation.
Right.
If your perturbation destroys, changes the equilibrium, then it means that there is no ordering anymore. So how can you hope to do it analytically?
Well, what I'm talking about here is not necessarily that the perturbations are of the same scale as the equilibrium. I'm just talking about you don't necessarily need a huge perturbation to change the structure of the magnetic field. Like if you could have a modest-sized perturbation which leads to a reorientation or breaking of the field lines. And that doesn't change the ordering about the scales, except in a local region. And so the question there is that even for those sorts of situations, I mean, it's okay to do these electromagnetic perturbations of a fundamentally electrostatic mode, because, you know, that's a magnetostatic problem. But even for small perturbations on the equilibrium, we don't know what that means. And one of the outstanding problems that we have not really made significant progress on in plasma physics in general is to understand, why are the electron losses so much faster than the ion losses under a lot of circumstances? You can create situations where with sheared flow, the ions are almost classical in their confinement, or neoclassical. But the electrons are still very anomalous. You know, they're still very lossy. What's going on? My own hypothesis, which I can't prove until you do the analysis, is that the electrons see field lines that are really not completely ideally connected, that they are broken in some way. The ions don't care. They're large Larmor orbits. If it's not perfect, they'll still go their merry way, right? But the electron structure, if they see imperfect field lines, even at this microscopic level like this, that could extend all the way out to the ion gyro radius scale, and you still would have a hard time detecting that. I mean, the ions would still be impervious to that. But the electrons, I'm suspecting that that's what's happening. That I can't prove it, but the sort of formalism that Dr. Chin and I worked on will put in place can still treat the magnetic perturbations in a perturbative sense like this, but allow you to look at the structure of the orbit equations in a more generic sort of way, so that you're in this that you can begin to address this type of problem. And we haven't done it yet, but this is anyway, and it may not amount to something substantive, but this is what we're doing research for, and it's an interesting challenge.